This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome, everybody. I'm Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. Sometimes things just happen and everything falls into place as if it's always belonged there, and for all the right reasons. Today's guest is a perfect example of that. He began his journey traveling from his native Norway to California, where he quickly found his place as an incredibly talented guitarist. He played first with Terry Hank, then with Charlie Musselwhite, and he's been working the last 15 years with Rick Estrin as part of his band, the Nightcats. Oh, and did I mention that he also started what has become one of the most requested and appreciated recording facilities across the country? That work has allowed him to record with the likes of Finest Tasby, Curtis Salgado, Alabama Mike, Tommy Castro, and Nick Moss, just for a start. But he's also been a key supporter of the Little Village Foundation, the nonprofit run by fellow musician Jim Pugh. Ladies and gentlemen, there's lots to talk about here. I'm pleased to welcome Christopher Kid Anderson to Time Signatures. How are you, man?
Hey, Jim, I'm doing great. I'm very impressed. You saved me a lot of time there with that introduction.
Well, I'm trying to get to the story, see? So I figure if I do a good introduction, then it makes it a little easier for you.
I think that is the story. I don't know what to say now, but I am very impressed. You didn't get anything wrong.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And listen, kid, we have to start somewhere, and I would love to hear about your start in music. Where did this journey begin for you, sir?
Oh, well, let's see. We're like way back. Like I started. I think it's some. You know, somewhere when I was like 8 or 9. I made a makeshift drum kit at home out of my sister's collection of bottle caps and some cassette, those are boxes that contain a bunch of cassettes. I made a drum set, and I used to fantasize that I was playing in my school cafeteria with Kiss.
Nice. Nice.
That was probably, that's the first remotely musical thing I can remember doing or thinking about. At the time, this is like 1991, and everybody was playing guitar for a brief time, about early 90s. I'm from a really small town. Like, you know, people in Norway haven't even heard of the town I'm from. It's
wow.
Yeah, it's
that's pretty damn small.
it's not like 1,500 people. It's, you know, it's not a technical time. It's maybe it might be a little village, technically. It's a very small, small community, and my neighbor and second cousin, old brother, older brother, Mats. He was about 4 or 5 years older than me, and he was, for that brief time when all the 15 and 16 year old kids were all playing guitar, they all got electric guitars, for about a year or something, and out of all those guys, he was like the best one in town. There was one, a guy named Rodney, who lived in the next actual town over, who was, rumored at being like really good, but my cousin, he was kind of the main guy, and he taught everybody to play, and I was only 11 at the time, but he told me, hey, if you'll get a guitar, I'll teach you how to play. So
Nice.
I did. I got one for my 11th birthday, and I don't know. I just took to it, I guess, pretty quickly, you know. And that was in January 1991, and by I think it was by March or April. The one tune that there was, like, a couple of tunes that everybody played. One of them was "Day Tripper" by the Beatles,
Oh, yeah.
and my cousin was, as the local authority on how to play guitar. He was the one who taught everybody to play it, and he showed it to everybody, something like this here. This is how he would play it. So that's how everybody learned to play "Day Tripper," and after playing for a couple of months, it must have been maybe about March or April, I was listening to the song and playing along, and I started going, I think it's actually, he had two notes wrong. He started with, but I've re discovered it was, and then
Okay.
I brought that up to him next time I saw him, and he got all quiet. And after that, he hardly ever played again. And all the other kids stopped playing guitar. I was the only one left playing guitar.
Wow.
That's when I, yeah, that was this, it was the spark. And we were listening to, it's a small town in Norway. We weren't the most advanced folks. We were a little behind it. Even though this was 1991,
Sure.
I was, we were listening to, like, the Beatles, Elvis, Chuck Berry, and the Shadows, the same stuff that really our parents were listening to. I don't, I mean, I did hear about Nirvana and some Metallica and some other bands, but that's what kind of like what the that's what everybody played was the old stuff. And
Right
then
on.
that's how I got started. And it's a fun thing to do. And I just started getting putting bands together. And since the place is so, there ain't nothing there. I mean, like, you can't find a drummer, you gotta make one. So my buddy, who was a year younger than me, his name was Daglish. He was I was 11, he was 10, and it was rumored and confirmed that his mother worked. She was the cleaning lady at this one church. It's a small town, but they got, like, five different churches there. There was rumored to be a Gretsch drum kit in one of the broom closets there, and she went and got it, and then we had a drum kit. And I just, he wasn't a particularly musically gifted fellow, so I just had to kind of learn to play drums so I could teach him. And
Sure.
that was the first little group I had. It was just me and a drummer.
Okay. Well, I'd like to skip ahead just a little bit to that
Please.
serendipitous meeting with Terry Hank when you were about 21. Now, as I
Oh, yeah.
understand it, you met Terry over there in Europe and you decided to come to the United States shortly thereafter. Talk about that meeting and what caused you to make that trip to come over here.
Well, the around the time I was 12, 13, I saw Robert Cray on TV playing a blues from this local nearby blues festival. And I remember my reaction was, I've heard of blues. And I go, that's blues. It was just like 10 seconds of boom, 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 boom. And seeing Richard Cousins on bass and Robert on the guitar. And I goes, that's blues? That's the coolest I've ever heard. So I became, interested in blues. I met a man named Morten Umlid, who was a fantastic blues guitar player, in a few different Norwegian bands, and he thought, he saw talent in me, and he offered to be my guitar teacher. And so at age 12, I started, learning about blues, going back to like he would give me a stack of albums every lesson. And T-Bone Walker, B.B. King, Otis Rush. I mean, I got the best education in classic blues. I was so fortunate, and I mean, I might be one of the very rare people on the planet today, who actually heard like Stormy Monday by T-Bone Walker before I heard the Allman Brothers version.
Oh, wow.
Like all the Led Zeppelins, all the blues songs Led Zeppelin did, I didn't listen to any like rock until I was I don't know my later in my teens. I heard that stuff by Howling Wolf first, which is really cool because most people go the other way. They discover the blues through like British rock acts and whatnot. Anyway, that's how we got into the blues. Being so in love with the music, and as I'm sure once once you get that obsession with the blues. I mean, I know I'm not sure if it's like this for every kind of music, but to me, I was like, it was, my whole life has revolved fully around it ever since. So the first, one big thing is I want to go to where that music is from. I want to
Sure.
be experience that culture. I want to, I just, I mean, I just, to me, that's just like, well, that's, this is what I want to do. That's where I need to be. So it was a pretty natural thing for me to, I always wanted to move to America, and because of the music. And then as I got a little older, I got another very lucky break, and they started this blues club in Oslo, and it's the only club I know in Norway who had live blues 7 nights a week.
Oh, wow.
And me and a bass player named Billy Treani from New York City, and this drummer, we became the house band, and what that meant is that I mean, they gotta have 365 blues shows a year. They're gonna run out of Norwegian blues acts pretty quick. So, so they started, the club would, they would fly over American artists that we would back up for like a week or two, and then, on to the next one. I played with the first one I played with was Nappy Brown.
Oh, man.
On his 70th birthday, I was 19. We played with Nappy Brown, Homesick James, the guitar
Man.
player. He was, I think he was maybe around 96. And I played with him. Jimmy Dawkins, Wyther Smith, Willie Big Ice Smith,
Man.
and it was just Jimmy Lee Robinson. It was at. And all and guys like Gary Primich too, and Bill Sims, was in the Heritage Blues Orchestra, yeah, and I did that for a few years. It's just like the greatest, another real life part, to the to the education that I just was so lucky to get that gig,
Yeah, no kidding.
almost pretty much all of these guys. When I would play with them, I'd kind of be like, "So, listen, man, if you need a guitar player in America, I'll move there." I was trying to get a gig and make my way to the United States, the Promised Land. There was, a couple of things, that didn't materialize, but then I met Terry Hank. He was Terry's wife is Norwegian. Her name is Vera, and
Okay.
so he was in Norway on Christmas, spending Christmas with her family after they got married. Looking around for some gigs, something to do, he connected with the Muddy Waters Blues Club, which it was called in Oslo. We played with him. We backed him up for about a week or two.
Wow.
Right around 2000, the last gig we played in Norway, that was the New Year's Eve, not the big one, but the 2000 to 2001. And
Okay.
I was 20, I just turned 21 around that time. And the day after New Year's 2001, Terry called me. I really like Terry. Yeah, I mean, I really like, we had a good, vibe. He played a lot of different stuff, all stuff I liked. I mean, just, I love the idea of playing with a sax player. I really, and he was just a really good guy. Like, it's, I felt like, if I were to go to America to try and, be a musician, if a guy like, if a guy like Terry brought me over, I would feel pretty, I would feel pretty comfortable because he just has that vibe, and my parents liked him,
That's
so
cool. Yeah.
he had some plans for a guitar player. He was in between guitar players. Mike Shermer had just left his band, but there was another guy named Rick Welter who was supposed to come out from Salt Lake City to join Terry Hank's band right at this time. So when I told Terry, hey man, I want to go to California, if you need a guitar player, I'm there, I'll move, and Terry says, oh man, that'd be cool, but I got this guy coming out. I just got a new guitar player. Anyways, New Year's Eve, we played together. The next day, Terry calls me, and this fellow Rick Welter, excellent guitar player, used to be in the Dynatones. He had a while we were in Norway, he had some tragic event in his family. I think his ex-wife committed suicide. It's
Oh
horrible.
boy.
It's probably the but because of this, he had he you know he had to stay in Salt Lake City, take care of their daughter. I mean, his life got turned upside down, so he wasn't coming out to California
Sure.
and Terry Hank band. But Terry calls me and he goes, hey man, turns out I do need a guitar player. Were you serious? And I go, yes sir, very much. So Terry, a couple of months later, March 7, 2001, first time on a plane, actually. I flew to San Francisco, and Terry picked me up, and he got me this little room for rent that was right down the street from him. And yeah, that was it. I played with him for 4 years. We went all over,
Wow.
California, the South. And we're still in touch. In touch. I mean, we're like family, really. He lives in Florida, but I've recorded all his albums. We've been, he's the closest I have to family in this continent. He's just just a great guy, man. I love Terry to death, and so even eventually I moved on to other bands, but we've always been, very closely connected. And
Yeah.
just that, I'm not in this touring band anymore, but I tell you what, when Terry's old Ford van finally died a few years ago, man, I love that thing so much. I was thinking, I was looking into maybe having somebody like airlift it into my backyard so I could just sit in
Just
it
for
and
old time's sake, huh?
just for old time's sake. I mean, that man, I mean, it was like in the back seat of that, just, out touring, playing the blues in America, and like it's just still you're all nestled in and safe. I don't think there's a happier, place for me on the planet than that van. So
Well, kid, you definitely got yourself firmly ensconced in the United States in the blues scene. You become recognized as a high-end guitarist, and you played it, as you said, with Terry for like 4 years. But that ultimately led you to going to work with Charlie Musselwhite, didn't it?
yes, it did. Oh, I lived in Santa Cruz, I was, in the music, I guess. I mean, it's all, Nobody took out an ad or anything. There was a it's still just make connections, make well, it's just well, I'm not I'm not a schmoozer, I'm not a brown noser, I don't have a card or stake out the lobby at the Blues Music Awards just to meet the but I love music, I love to play, and I love people, and I make friends, and one of the first people I met over here that I just instantly had this connection with, like he's just like he's like we've been friends forever, was June Corr, the drummer,
Okay.
and I had seen him and play with Little Charlie and the Nightcats in Oslo in 1998, and he was a great drummer. Sometimes he played with Terry, and just the first time I met June, we were like, I just felt like I had a best friend instantly, and then and we we were very good friends, and he started playing in Charlie's band at some point. He's been with the band well over 20 years now,
Wow.
and I would go, people go in and out of bands, and they so they had an opening. I think it was Kirk Fletcher had been the guitar player for a while,
Sure.
and he got offered a gig with the Fabulous Thunderbirds. So this would be like 2003, 2004. Yeah,
Okay.
2003, 2004. Charlie had asked his band, is there anybody you can think of that who would be good for the gig? And June told him about me, and it really, that was kind of that was really it. I had the only time I'd met Charlie was again at that Notodden Blues Festival in Norway in 1993 when I was 13 years old, and I have his autograph and everything that I got from him back
How
then.
cool is that?
Yeah, I don't think he remembers it, and he was, I mean, Charlie was like, that was a big deal. I mean, Terry, I love Terry and what Terry does, the cool thing about one of the cool things about Charlie is that a lot of my friends already were harmonica players in Norway, and you get a gig like that with a guy that people actually have heard of, like he was a legend already then.
Sure.
So that was a anytime something would happen where I could feel like I could really impress my old friends back in Norway, that was like, I've done something now. So
Yeah.
yeah, so June recommended me. I think Charlie called me, and he's like, yeah, you want to do it? I mean, we didn't play. I mean, we just talked for a little bit, and he asked if I had like a CD or anything where he could hear me play. And I go, yeah, and I had just made one, my first solo CD. So another thing. I just mailed him that, and really didn't hear anything more about it. It was kind of it was kind of a bummer when Terry found out that I was leaving the band, because we played the Biscuits and Blues in San Francisco, and this lady who was there, a friend of ours, who was really has the her finger on the pulse of everything that's happening in the local and international blues world. She walked up to Terry during the break and said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear you losing your guitar player."
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh.
Seriously, like I said, I talked to Charlie on the phone. I sent him my CD. I hadn't heard anything more. I didn't even know I had the gig. I didn't think so.
Oh man.
So that was, then Terry came, "Hey, well, I just heard," and I was like, "Oh man,
The proverbial fart in church, right? Man.
But I mean, you know what? He was going to find out. I mean, I kind of felt like I felt like I found out at the time too, because I hadn't done a single gig, I hadn't met Charlie, I hadn't played with him, but evidently I had the gig. As it turns out,
Wow.
I did. Maybe, she saved me the anguish of trying to figure out how to tell Terry myself,
Yeah, but man, that's crazy.
Well,
I'm going to go ahead and turn the page here for a second. As
all
we
right.
record this interview, you're about to celebrate your 20 years with Greaseland Studios. How did this project come together for you ultimately? And you've recorded some of the biggest names in the blues, as we talked about earlier, haven't you?
Certainly a lot of my heroes and favorites, and of the ones who are left. Well, to me, it's pretty natural. It's music is my thing. I mean, I play guitar, but I play other instruments too. And I'm just, that's, it's kind of what I'm about. It's actually amazing to me, even to this day, how many like professional musicians who don't have the capability or to like, make it just a decent recording of themselves at home, people, think you have to have all this stuff in this huge facility to do a recording. I mean, which is, you absolutely do not,
Right.
You just gotta, know what you want to sound like, and just figure out how to put that in, on a recording.
Now, is this just something that was self-taught? Trial and error?
In some ways. I mean, I didn't go to no school or anything for it or take lessons, but I always wanted to, I mean, I make music. First time I went in the recording studio, I mean, my favorite, most of my learning, most of everything I, music I heard, learned about, is from recorded music, listening to albums, especially in Norway. I just love the experience of, especially like, a lot of the old blues records, from the 50s and 60s, and Muddy's old records and Howling Wolf, because I mean,
right,
I put those on and as a kid in Norway, like 13 years old, and you hear Spoonful. I mean, it's transformative. I mean, it takes you on a, It's like Jumanji.
I get it, man. I totally get it.
Yeah, you're just in this other world, and you just, have all these images of, what was it like, and it just conjures up this stuff, and there was just real magic, in those records particularly, and it's there's also something that, I would hear a lot of newer stuff. And everything's kind of like just a little more generic and safe and streamlined and just kind of very matter of factly. I mean, yeah, they record it. It sounds like the band playing, but where's that, where are those, where are all the ghosts, where are all the mysterious stuff that you can't quite make out,
right.
All this, ambient stuff that just, the atmosphere, and also, I would go in the studio sometimes with, with Terry, with other bands. And as probably most musicians will tell you, that the first few times they went in the studio, it was, kind of, underwhelming or disappointing. I mean, they would, nothing sounds, everything just sounds way less exciting than you want it to. It's just a, it's usually a disappointment for people, It's just stuff will often sound like very dull, and a lot of that I think is just, I mean, some of the my favorite records, they're from the, earlier days of recording, and there was no nor there, there it wasn't streamlined how everything should sound. Oh, this is the proper way to EQ a bass guitar. They didn't have none of that. You have to pan the guitars left and right, and you have to have the bass, the drums in the center. There was, I mean, they were just people just going for it, and around and experimenting, and also, some of these guys that recorded for the, for the first time, it was just, that I don't, I just we're missing that vibe in the most modern new recordings. Every time I go into the studio, any studio, like all the engineers you meet, they never heard of Willie Johnson.
Right.
They're not into any of this. If I try and explain the sounds I'm hearing, they have no point of reference, because I mean, because
But
they.
clearly the sound that Greaseland has become known for resonates with the people you're recording with. I mean,
Oh yeah.
I
Well,
mean,
I'm
I
not.
can
I
tell you
think this is
that.
an experience that very many musicians have, and I'm like a conduit, because I didn't start having. I'm not an engineer. I mean, I do engineering, but it all comes from just wanting to make music,
Well, and clearly you found a way to do it in such a way that you've got a you have a sound that when people hear something that you record from Greaseland, they know that it came from your studio because you're known,
Thank
that's
you.
what you're known for.
I hope so. I mean, that's eventually it's gonna it, you know it permeates, because well basically yeah, to boil it down, I think what separates me, I to me, you like all the equipment, the location, it doesn't matter. The most important thing is that, do you have a vision? Do you can you hear in your head? Do you have a goal in mind? Do you hear the album, the record, before it's been made? And if you have a vision and you can hear that, then you can start, making, and then you can start creating it and making it reality. This is, I think, people I work with, I mean, it's, they're all people, and most musicians, they do have a vision, but there's, so many instances they don't. If they have an engineer, a studio, somebody who's not, from a different background or whatever, which they usually will be, they don't know how to communicate their vision. They don't know how to put it in words that this other person can understand.
Understood, yes.
Even when I play with Terry, as well, sometimes when I'm the producer, I'm also a conduit between the front, the artist or songwriter, and the band, because I mean, a lot of musicians just don't know how to communicate with each other. I mean,
Yeah.
I'm not talking about just being dysfunctional, which of course we are too, but I always thought, I started out, teaching myself to play drums so I could teach my drummer how to be a
Right.
drummer. Same thing with bass. I was always very, if I hear something that perks my ear up, I just want to, I want, okay, I want to know what that is, and I want to know how to do it. I don't have to be, I just want to know, what are these, these building blocks. So, a lot of people don't do that. I mean, Terry Hank, for instance, I've done many records with him, and he's a great example of a guy. He has a vision, but he doesn't have the means to communicate it a lot of times to the other guys in terms that mean anything to them, that makes sense. A lot of times Terry will go, I think the drums should be like, and he would literally go like this. And they go, and he's not even making a sound, but I can see, I
He's
look
just
at him.
conveying it to you somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, but I look at Terry and I can see this record is literally playing in his head right now. You know, is it, he doesn't, you know, I gotta help him get these guys to come close to what he's, and
Yes,
that
sir.
involves a bit of actual like mind reading.
Yep. No, I completely get it. I'm a photographer, and many times I see the shot before I take it. And when I get it, it's that eureka moment, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's hard to explain to somebody else, but you're a visionary. That's what you are. You're a visionary, and you know how to bring that to fruition. And that, I think, is what really separates you from a lot of the other people that own studios out there. But I want to turn the page, kid, because I'm dying to talk to you about Little Village. Now, you made it clear you've done some recordings with you and your wife. You're not here to sell, you're here to tell. And I want to help you. I want to promote that.
Well, you asked me before if I had anything, to promote,
Right.
and that's like,
Yeah.
honestly, my, you know, I'm a, you know, I'm, you know, I can say I'm, you know, that I'm pretty good at a few things, and there are many things I'm terrible at. And many things I don't want anything to do with at all.
Right. Well, talk.
And when it comes to music, I have, in a way, I think what I've done is I've created like a cocoon, like a bubble where I can, exist in here, in this space, in my studio, which is also, my house. I mean, there's
Yeah.
no, and I can pretend like it's n 1969 or whatever. I mean, the thing is, when you go out in the world and you see, all the stuff you got to do to promote your stuff, and you got to mail CDs, and you got to talk to people and
Right.
make phone calls and connections and all this stuff that just it just it, it I mean it, it makes me shiver with because it's just like I love the music, I love the creative part of it, and I've kind of and pretty successfully designed my life to where I don't want to worry about any of that. I do the stuff that I love, and I can sit here and I can pretend like like it's important, and to a few people it is, and you
I think to a
have
lot of people it is.
you have to believe, you can't be an artist, you can't, be a visionary or do something creative unless you like, you got to think it matters,
Yes,
because
sir.
When you go out there and you see what really happens to our music after, when you put it out in the world, you just see how much music there is out there and how little most of it does. I mean, it's depressing.
Yeah.
I don't want to, I don't need to be involved in the activities that's gonna make me disillusioned and kill my enthusiasm for the, for the music and the art, because
Yeah.
that's really all I care about. So I'm kind of like anti-promotion, even when me and Lisa made our CD. I talked to Jim and I was like, well, she, I made an album, she made an album, and I was like, what if we just put them together, two albums on one disc, and it's the most bizarre format that nobody, as far as I know, has ever done before. How do you alphabetize it? How do you categorize it? I mean, it's just like it's just filled with really like self-sabotage.
Well, kid, I'd like to ask you, if I may, please. I'd love to hear how you got together with Jim Pugh. You referenced him a minute ago, and
Yes.
you have done some phenomenal work with the Little Village Foundation. But tell me about that introduction. How did things come together for you and Jim?
Oh man. Well, I mean, it is true. It was very what's that word? Serendipitous.
Yes, indeed.
I think well, one thing is Jim Pugh and Terry Hank go way back. Way back.
Okay.
They've known each other. So I actually played with Jim on some shows with Terry, and back when he was with Robert Cray, was Robert Cray's keyboard player for about 25 years. Everybody knew him from there. He was on many records that I loved. I knew who he was before I moved to the States. I met Terry, and we actually did some stuff with Jim, and I was, I was very excited to meet Jim, and really wanted to impress him. It seems like for about the first 10, 12 years I knew Jim, every time we'd do something together, I would do something to like win him over, and I feel like at the end of the night he'd be like, "Oh man, he's pretty good. That guy's pretty good." And then next time I see him, it'll be like I start all over again. So that's how I felt. Anyways, but then we connected doing a I was they hired my studio to do a album with Charlie Owen, who's a great singer from the Bay Area. Jim was the producer, I was the engineer, and we worked together on that. We had a good experience working together. And we had a little hissy fit with each other, which was good to get that out of the way, and after that, the thing that really kind of spurred it on was Jim, had the idea for Little Village Foundation after he didn't play with Robert Cray anymore, and he wanted to do something different, basically he had the idea to have a record label, but have it be a nonprofit organization. Because realistically, the chances that you're going to make money having a record label in 2020 or whatever year it is or was, are pretty slim. Anyway, it's about up there with starting. Like, I'm going to start a video store, his idea is that it's all based on donations. And we just help. Great artists that aren't necessarily what Alligator or somebody a profit-based record label. If you got to make money off
Right.
your artists and their CD, you need people who sell a lot of CDs, people who can tour and hustle and all that stuff
Right, right.
before it. I hate. I mean, I like touring. I'm playing,
Sure.
And there's a lot of artists that are like incredible artists, but they're not gonna be in that game, So a regular record label that would, was just they would just lose money on these guys. Little Village is like, yeah, we can lose money. As a matter of fact, we don't take any money for like if a Little Village record, sells 20 million copies, that's all the artist's money. That's we
Yes,
don't
sir.
have a, and they
Yes,
own
sir.
everything, and Little Village pays for the production creation. That's where I come in, because I was doing stuff like that on my own ever since I first got a re recording studio. I had a Like Finest Tasby.
Yes, sir.
I played, I met him and I told, and I was like, he was just such a great singer. I mean, when he's, what, like a real blues singer, I was just so magical playing with him. And he's so, he's so underappreciated. I told him, hey man, I got a studio. I have lots of friends to play. I'd love to make some music together. And it was just, it was, that was the spirit. It wasn't like, and my most rewarding stuff that I ever did was stuff that you did just because you love it, because not because, hopping Hans is paying me to record his band. It's like I always had passion project. You got your stuff you got to do to pay the rent,
Sure.
and then you got your passion projects, which is what you live for. And I had quite a few of those. And then Jim had the brilliant, and he was able to put this whole thing together where basically I, a way for me to do my passion projects and still get paid for it.
Yes, sir.
Because it's all from based on donations. People like it and they're donating and it's working. And it's because of that, I mean, I've been able to do so really so many things that I probably, many of them I would have done anyways for free, because it's what I love. But thank God, like that Jim is a, he's smarter than me, and he found a way where we can we can do stuff like that, and we don't have to eat Vienna sausage and day old used spam.
So, kid, I have to ask you, man. I need to address this album that you worked on recently. That new album by Sean Mac McDonald, Have Mercy.
Oh yeah.
The first time I heard that album, and I'm from the heart, man. I remember telling my friends it had, if you close your eyes, it reminded me of Sun Studios 1956. Am I close to what you were going for?
Well, absolutely. I mean, he's a, he's a throwback. A few years ago, I think I started, seeing him on Facebook, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, we've, you get so tired of hearing, but it's like, it's, the blues scene that we know anyways has been, it's kind of like, been dominated by, kind of like white hippies and blues rock, and then, I mean, and I love all that stuff, but I just, I never, I didn't even dare hope that, there would come a time where, like, man, there's a whole wave actually, of
Yes.
young black kids,
Yes.
boys and girls,
Yep.
and who, are really deeply getting into, the legacy of the blues,
And they're making a statement that this is what they want to stick to.
Yeah, I
You
mean,
know, and that's what's refreshing to me.
yeah, I was, yeah, I mean, I see a guy like, when I saw Sean, man, I was like, it was man, I feel like there's one of the few reasons to be to be happy, to to be living in this day and age, that for me, just could, yeah, I'm just, I saw him and I was just, I loved it right away. He was a few years ago, and he's sitting, he's playing Pee Wee Creighton, B.B. King,
Wow.
old B.B. King stuff, and I mean, it was just, all the same stuff I was into when I was when I you know, the world of blues, open up to me, like, the old recorded blues, and it's not necessarily what, you would see at a blues festival, but it's this whole, gold mine of incredible, American art that's and just that, just the fact that it's like, and I've always maintained this. I've always said, you don't need to like dress it up like, I mean, the music of the originators, the music of, Muddy Waters, and Skip James, and this stuff is so powerful. It's so powerful. Somebody's always going to find it and be attracted to it. And you don't have to, do anything to it. I mean, it's a, you don't have to change it to make it cool. I mean, that's great too, when it's, I love all the hybrids, and you take the tradition and mix it with all your other influences. I love all that stuff, but it's just, I mean, it's just that confirmation that for one thing, this is music is so enduring, and it's gonna live, forever. But also to see, DK Harrell and doing it, and Harrell Davenport, Young Rel. I'm just working
Oh,
on
yeah.
his upcoming album right now, and Sean Mack. I mean, it's like, it's really the most, it is currently, and probably will remain, my favorite, thing going on the planet.
Yep.
Right now.
And I wanted to ask you, I was going to ask you an off-the-cuff question here. Is DK Harrell the real deal? And I got a feeling I know the answer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's a, I'm wearing his t-shirt.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, I've interviewed him twice. I mean, I like the guy. And he really comes across as genuine. And I think that's
Yes,
something.
he's yeah, he's got more than just, he's got more than most, he's got that he's not just a great player, and then, I mean, there's lots of great players, and but he's got that thing, like BB. I mean, obviously he's, his was a, to say BB King was a huge influence on him is kind of an understatement. But he's just got this great, Gregory, this man of the people kind of, I mean, when he gets up there, and this is, this is the, even the music aside, I mean, like, people just root for him. You just, and that's, it's an amazing quality. I mean, he really, it's not an act. He is actually a great actor, a great comedic actor, because he has me stitches sometimes doing different characters. But he is a very genuine, heartfelt guy, and I mean, I love him. I mean, I just really, really, I mean, he sent me a message for my birthday that made me cry. I love, I love all these kids. But DK is also, I guess I would say he's the first one of this wave, the new wave that we recorded at Little Village. He did the album The Right Man, and the other thing, when I talked to him before, I'd see him on Facebook, some BB King tribute shows, young man. He's just, and of course, I mean, they're all very young, and they're all, they're a bunch of hard-headed little gets and they think they know everything.
I'm
Just
a
like
father, I get it.
just like I used to be,
Well, kid,
but he, oh, yes, go
I
ahead.
was just going to say, I don't want to miss this opportunity. I wanted to talk to you. There's a
Well,
young
let me
man.
just say, don't
Oh,
finish
go
my
ahead.
thought.
Go
Well,
ahead.
when I first talked to DK before the first album, his hopes and dreams, his aspirations were so modest. It was like, well, I'd really like to be able to, have a band where I can, pay the guys enough, like maybe 200 a night so they can, so they'll stay with me for a while. Maybe we can do some festivals. I mean, his aspirations were so modest that I just this morning I wake up, he's in India. I've never been to India. I mean, he's in his trajectory is crazy. He's like he's taken off like a rocket ship. I mean, and I couldn't happen to a better guy. I mean, yeah. I to be honest with you, I mean, I went and seen his show. His band is great. I went and seen him on the Blues Cruise, and everywhere I see DK, I'm like, I'm like, I feel like his dad or something, because I'll be out in the audience and just, with tears in my eyes,
That's cool.
because
That's cool.
I'm so proud of him.
Well, I've got a gentleman by the name of Vincent Hayes, who recorded some music back in the day, and he's a big fan of yours, and primarily because of a new album that you did by Tommy Castro called Closer to the Bone.
Oh, yeah.
Vince wanted me to ask you a couple of questions regarding your recording technique. Specifically, you
All right.
mentioned the moody retro feel that you incorporated into this album. But he noted that it was done with subtlety and it really caught his attention. So he wanted me to ask you if this had been recorded to tape or was it direct to digital? And was the vibe something you planned on or did it just kind of happen organically?
Well, when I first started, I had a tape machine, which I loved, and used it for about two records. But no, I record digital now. I'm in Pro Tools, and there's no way I could have the same level of productivity, unless I was, doing it digitally. And I'm happy with that. Because this goes to the second question. Like, again, it's like, it's the vision. You gotta have the vision. If you have the vision, it's you can record to a potato, and then get
Can
your
I quote
point.
you on that?
And get your get your point across. If you don't have the vision, you could, I mean, you can have like, Ray Charles's personal tape recorder, and it's not going to make any difference, any real difference. But yeah, I record digitally, and I do many things in every product, to make it, to give it the sound and feel of analog recording, because I do love the sound of tape and analog recording and what
Yes,
happens.
sir.
So yeah, so I simulate that. I mean, I do use, a lot of old microphones, two preamps, and also, just the room. And I mean, it's really, I really appreciate the things he's saying about about the vibe and the moodiness of the, and it's, it's deliberate. And he also said, subtlety, which is, I mean, that's true, because Tommy, well, Tommy, first of all, the cool thing about that for me making that record is I've known Tommy for a long time, and I know he's, I mean, people think of him as like a, pop, well, I mean, like a, blue soul rock and blues singer, very commercial. I mean, he's a very good looking guy, and he's, and he can get away with wearing a tight t-shirt, which That's good for him. And he's popular, and he and so he's you think he's like on the more like I don't know, commercial poppy side or whatever. But I mean, but I know Tommy, and I've known him for a long time, and we have a lot of the same decrepit old Bay Area motherfuckers that raised us both. And the thing about Tommy is that he loves the blues. He's from the blues, he loves the blues. He just really loves that shit. And that's why he can, so I know he can do it. And I wanted to show that side of him. And I think, if he, if next week Tommy Castro had no more tour bus, no more blues crews, and he had to, and he'd get to play every night at the saloon in North Beach and live upstairs, he would be happy. So, but at the same time, like, he is, he is it. I don't want to, those kind of vibes, that kind of mood in this atmosphere, all that stuff I'm talking about, I always want that in there. That's a big part of the reason why I'm even doing this, is
Right,
because
right.
I want that stuff back. At the same time, I know I can't, if I go too far overboard with it, then people are going to think there's something wrong with your stereo, it's going to come out on Alligator, and they want stuff that sounds, sounds like commercially competitive, whatever you want to call it, so I really, it's just about finding a balance,
Right.
and again, like I said, if you have if you have the sound in your head, then you can, at least then you got a goal to work towards, and of course, the longer you do it, the more you do it, the more you learn, the easier it will be for you to get those sounds from your head and onto the
Sure.
tape or the hard drive now. Yeah, that's, but it's, of course, things can always change along the way, and they do all the time. Also, like, to his point, and as sometimes you do kind of find the personality of a record, while you're making it, and not before, but it's some, stuff will materialize, and you got to be open to
Yep.
that,
Yep. All right, kid, where can we send people to learn more about you? Maybe purchase some of those fantastic albums you've worked on, or maybe book Rick Estrin and the Night Cats for a gig. We'll put all the appropriate links out there for you, sir.
Well, that's those are, Little Village Foundation. That's that's so much of the music that I work on is, is with Little Village and facilitated. I mean, they really made it possible for me to have a very a career, with working with artists that I really love, and just,
Sure.
so yeah, littlevillagefoundation.com, I think it is. And also, and if you want to see me play and with a really great band and my best friends, then the rickestrin.com, Rick Estrin and the Night Cats. I saw Rick in 1998 in Oslo. It was the first concert I went to after I moved to Oslo. It was at the Oslo Blues Club, because,
Oh,
like I
how
said, I'm
cool.
from a small town, and Oslo is the only city in Norway you can be a musician even. First show I saw was Rick Estrin and the Night Cats, Little Charlie and the Night Cats with Jim Gore on drums, and Rick Estrin. And I remember looking at the guy and goes, man, I would sure love to be in a band like that. I didn't think I could be in that band because they seemed pretty attached to Little Charlie on the guitar. But as it worked out, me and Rick been playing for 15 years,
That's
and
so
I love it.
cool.
He's I just, I could do a whole nother show just talking about him, man. Rick is one of the best human beings, maybe the best. That besides being, what everybody knows about him. He's just also has the biggest heart, and he's, he's like the first Little Village record was me and Rick after we met Willie Walker and heard Willie Walker and heard his story and heard this amazing singer, and who wasn't doing anything, and me and Rick were gonna, we were just gonna do it. We're gonna make this album. We're gonna, and if we have to pay for it, whatever. It's because it needs to be done. It has this, this is, which we got to follow our hearts, and thank God during the making of that album is when Jim, it would, Jim got involved. He was playing on it, and then he starts telling me about Little Village. That became the first Little Village album.
And I actually found a copy of that album. I have a copy on CD, and I am so proud to have that. It's really cool to look back at where Little Village started.
It's absolutely, and I mean, I could easily be the best music I've ever made. right there. I mean, that's that's a really, Willie Walker was, he was really something special, man. He came, from somewhere else. And,
Yeah. Well, Kid Anderson, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today on Time Signatures. Hopefully, you guys will end up over here in Michigan soon so I can get out to
Michigan.
see y'all doing your thing. But thank you so much for coming on today.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure. Great
All right.
talking to you, man. You seem like a wonderful catch.
And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Christopher Kid Anderson, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham. Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.